My name is Allie, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Lana Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Breck will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Breck. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things, and the wisdom to know the difference. Christine will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Christine. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we continued to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
John will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm John, and I'm an alcoholic. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Step five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of the meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Neil.
Neil, alcoholic. I want to thank Eddie for asking me to speak. It's an honor to speak in front of my home group. My sobriety date is November 5th of 2008. This is my home group, as I said. I have a sponsor. His name is Matt. I sponsor men, and I work the 12 steps in my life. And it's for me, it's a daily program, and it's been a bridge back to life, and it's still a work in progress, but I have nothing but good things to say about this room. To give a quick, synopsis of how I got here, when I was a kid, basically through high school, I was shy, scared of my own shadow, scared of people, didn't want to be in any social environments, had a lot of anxiety, and I was just generally miserable. And the way my solution for all of this was to isolate. It was to kind of hide away, to be invisible, to listen to crazy dark kinds of music, and just escape. And I never drank through high school because I come from a very alcoholic family. Everyone in my family is either in recovery or just embarrassing fall down drunks. And it was kind of like this taboo. My father got sober when I was about 4 years old, so. Alcohol, in my household just wasn't available. I basically just, I somehow got, excellent grades, and I played sports, and on the surface, I guess on paper, things looked pretty good, but I was just really miserable. And when I got to college, I was just, it's a good thing I found alcohol when I did, because I don't know, what would have happened if I had gone along the way I had gone. My first drink was, I was my freshman year of college. I was in my room. My roommate had left a bottle of vodka behind, and there were kids partying down the hall, and I was just like, I got to do something about this. So I just started drinking it. I mixed it with some Kool-Aid mix and some water, and, I just dimmed the lights, and it was like psychic change right there for me. It was profound. Like, that effect that the alcohol had on me, it just wasn't normal. I mean, I knew from the moment I started feeling the effects, like the fear, the anxiety, the depression, the self-consciousness, the self-awareness, it slipped. And I knew from that moment on, like, this was it, And it wasn't even, like, everything in my life became secondary. Grades, family, friends, everything. And I knew that alcoholism was in my blood, and I didn't care because it was better than the solution I had before it. So for the next 15 years, it was, progressively worse. Every relationship I was in ended because of my drinking. My career, I managed to hold down a career, but it basically stalled and went nowhere. There were arrests, hospitals, institutions, the whole thing. At the end of this, basically towards the end of my bottom, I'll just give you a snapshot. I'm waking up on the front lawn of a friend's house in Saratoga. I didn't black out often, but I had blacked out this night. I'm covered in blood, which I think most of it was my own, I'm fairly certain. And apparently I had taken a psychedelic substance in the middle of a blackout. So, I don't know if anyone's ever, I don't want to talk about drugs, but just to give you an idea of where I was that night. And I ran into my friend's house, and I had a bunch of people that I was acquaintances with that were in there, and I ran in, freaking out, covered in blood. They think I killed someone. I can't figure out, why the house is crooked and who these people are. And, this was kind of par for the course, So, I ended up hurting my neck and getting a few injuries. I got a 2-week leave of absence for work. This is, summer of 2006. And, I got 2 weeks off of work, and I kind of went on a two-week blackout. I mean, I really don't have many memories. I remember playing speed chess against someone in Washington Square Park. Like, and that guy actually recognized me a couple years later. But like that, this is craziness, right? So at the end of that, I kind of woke up and I was in an outpatient facility in a rehab out in Pennsylvania. And I was kind of freaked out because, you know, they took away all my medications that I supposedly needed and all these wonderful things. And, you know, it was a great experience. I learned about AA in this rehab. It was 12-step based. It was the longest I had been separated from alcohol since my first drink. I mean, so, you know, after my head started to clear a little bit, I realized, you know, this is really good. And when I got out, I found this group for a little while. But, you know, I had the wrong motives for coming to AA. I was still, you know, I never really surrendered. And I wasn't willing to do any of the work, and I managed to last about 70 days or so, and I started to get a bit depressed because things weren't changing, and, you know, I didn't want to really read the book. I thought it was kind of stupid. So, you know, I went out. I picked up, and I really, at that moment, I made a conscious decision because I knew and I had learned about how fatal my disease was. I made a conscious decision, you know, that I would rather die an alcoholic death than live a sober life. And, you know, and that's kind of what I tried to do for 3 months. And by the end, I was, you know, I didn't die, obviously, thank God. But, you know, I was, you know, locked away in my apartment. You know, the blinds were pulled down. I wouldn't go out during the day. The only time I ever left was to go to the ATM machine. The only person that I ever hung out with was my alcohol salesman. And it was like one of these crazy, just, you know, and there was just a moment where I was just, I don't know what it is, clarity or just humility or just surrender, but there was a moment where I just looked at myself and I was just like, this is not the person I wanted to be when I grew up, you know? And I finally realized that I couldn't beat this thing, you know? And I had that moment of surrender, you know, I lost the battle, but I won the war kind of moment, and it was a window of opportunity for me to get back in the rooms, and I took it. I went to two meetings that day. I reconnected with my sponsor, and I got right into the steps, you know, because I was desperate. And, you know, when I first came around, I thought the idea of God and a higher power was weak and just, you know, I didn't want to hear it. I thought I was smarter than that. And, you know, I had this negative opinion about religion. And and it kept me drinking for a pretty long time. But when I started to realize that... first of all, I didn't have any other options other than death. And second of all, when I started doing the work, things started happening in my life. Like, I made amends with my family and, you know, they began to trust me. I redeveloped. My brothers began to look up to me after a while because I just kept taking the next right action. And I took suggestion from my sponsor. And you know, people in this room, when I was coming around, I'm a pretty shy person, and I've gotten over a lot of that through my sobriety. But, you know, people reached their hands out. They gave me their phone numbers. They called me. And, like, walking into this room, and I can identify with any newcomer that walks in here, and they're just like, you know, this is pretty scary. But I can guarantee you a lot of the people that are in this room right now did not look like this when they first came in. I mean, this, you know, I can speak for myself. You know, you wouldn't have recognized me. And you know, I didn't lose, you know, I lost all the bad things, but I kept all the good things, you know. A lot of the things I came in here with are gone now, you know, relationships, the job, all that stuff, things that were just negative influences on my life. But, you know, the things I've gotten are so much better. I have friends that I can actually, you know, talk to about things that are on my mind or feelings. And, you know, I got my career back in order, and I show up to work on time, and I pay my bills on time, you know. When my mother calls me, I answer the phone, and she doesn't have to, like, I didn't realize the damage that I did to the people that loved me for so long, because I just thought, you know, I was a poor me, you know. I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm just trying to hurt myself, and you know who, you know. I just want to sit at home, lock myself in my apartment, and drink. That's the kind of alcoholic I was. And what I didn't realize was all the collateral damage that did to people who actually cared about me. And, you know, it's one of the awakenings I've had in this program was just to be there, you know, as a brother, as a friend, you know, as an uncle, you know, just it's nice to go to bed with a clear conscience and to wake up with some form of hope that, you know, there's something in store for me every day, and it's not necessarily, you know, all this doom and gloom. And I've gone through some bad times, you know, in sobriety, and it hasn't been easy all the time, but I've learned, by going through my emotions sober, I've actually learned, like, that emotional sobriety and how to deal with feelings and how to basically come out the other side better for it. You know, all that development that I lost in all those years of drinking. So, you know, my sobriety date is I actually changed my date because I had taken some medication, and I talked to my sponsor, and we decided it was the right thing to do. But, you know, the honesty, it's all about honesty, and I'm getting the goodbye sign. So thanks for listening, and thanks for my sobriety.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Diana.
I think that's good. Yep. My name's Diana. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Joan for asking me to speak and tell you what an enormous honor it is to be asked to speak before my home group. I have to be quick with this because I have two sobrieties. So I'm going to start with where I came from. I grew up in England. I had two parents who were daily drinkers. It would be a very strange day that my parents didn't have a drink in the evening, and on the weekends they always had drinks at lunchtime too. And when I got to be 15 or 16, I got a sherry, and this is all about being, you know, sophisticated and worldly, and I didn't think anything of it. So as I grew up and finally went into the work world, it was simple. I had an apartment, I had a closet, and in my closet I had a bottle of sherry, and when I came home from work, I had a glass of sherry. Was what you sensibly did when you'd had a tense day. I was working in television, and we were in the time of live production, and it was very tense. So I went along, and I got into trouble when in my early 20s. My first blackout was age 21. I drank too much champagne and couldn't remember how I left that party and what I was doing, where I fetched up. I didn't think anything of it. I blamed the champagne. That's what happens when you drink cheap champagne. Always the rationale. I eventually decided that it was time to come to the United States for a year and see how things were going, you know, what it was like to be over here. And I went to work for CBS News. I started to date, and it seemed to me that the guys I dated drank more than the Englishmen that I'd been dating, and that might be because liquor was a little cheaper here than it was in the work world where I had come from. I married somebody whose drinking pattern was definitely far advanced from mine, and I immediately adopted his. He was a lawyer at CBS, and I felt that he was so fantastic that maybe by marrying him, I'd make myself feel all right. And of course, that was one of the reasons that made me drink. But I thought marrying him would make me feel all right. I married his drinking pattern, and it followed me for the next 8 years. I'm going to quickly zip through this one. I had two small children. I did not work when I had small children. I was somebody who should have worked and continued to work and given my children quality time, but I didn't. I stayed home, and my drinking increased. I eventually fetched up in rehab at Smithers in 1973. I did 28 days, and I was so appalled at the idea that I was in an institution and I couldn't get out that I was just overwhelmed with shame, and I swore I would never, ever do this again. I left, and I got a sponsor. I came to meetings. I did all the things I should do, except I really didn't read the big book, and I really only skated through the steps. I went to meetings for very many years. I stayed sober for 34 in all, and I skated. I didn't do any of it in depth. And eventually, after about 18 years, I stopped going regularly at all. Once in a while, I would go to a woman's meeting, and I basically thought I had it nailed. And I didn't know that feeling of having it nailed was my disease. I got divorced. Eventually, having gotten sober, I got divorced from the gentleman whose drinking pattern I emulated. And in 83, I was single again in my early 40s. And a couple of years went by, and I met up and started to see somebody else who was just somebody I was very involved with and absolutely adored, and thought he was not an alcoholic, thought I've dodged the bullet, I haven't done the typical thing. And we had 20 really good years, and I was part-time stepmother to his two-year-old, and I was raising, of course, my two children, who by now were, you know, they were on in years, they were in their teens, and one of them was displaying some signs of the disease. Everything went along pretty much okay. We had a good 20 years together. And then around year 20, I saw that the relationship was not in good shape, and I buried my head. I buried my head, and I got depressed, and I didn't do anything. And as I saw him become a wine bore, I mean a major wine bore, he would dealt with it on an intellectual level, but he drank too. And all of a sudden, it was a big thing in his life, and I had wine all over the place, wine in the kitchen. And it was a big strain, and I didn't deal with it the way somebody who was truly sober would have, by telling him to, you know, cork it, leave it, you know, lock it up, whatever. And in 07, he announced he'd like to leave the marriage. He was not going to stay in this marriage. And I learned later that he was going back to one of his old girlfriends. I was in such pain at that point, and this is May of 07, that I, with no net of contacts in AA, with no habit of meetings, with no sponsor, with none of those things, but with all of those years of sobriety, did not think twice before I went to the liquor store. Said, I'm in so much pain, this is totally justified. The only good thing I did was I did not ask for the quart of vodka that was normally what I got through every day in my previous drinking career. I selected a bottle of dry white wine and went home and proceeded to drink one bottle of dry white wine every single evening that I was not with friends for the next 7 months. And if you think it's easy to drink one bottle of dry white wine a night and stay doing that, it's not worth doing it. So I'm in the middle of a nasty divorce, and at some point I realize maybe I should be on my own team and the drinking should stop, because it's certainly not getting me anywhere, and I'm certainly not getting a lot out of it, and it might be time to stop. And as I am to be deposed in the next few days, I finally decide I must go back to AA. I go back to AA, put my hand up and say, I'm back. And everybody, thank God, said welcome. And it couldn't be the more welcoming and more wonderful a place to return to. I did not feel shamed. I felt relieved that I'd gotten back, because I knew how lucky I was that I'd been able to come back. That doesn't happen to everybody. And I started to go to meetings on a regular basis. I had a temporary sponsor. She was a lovely, kind, supportive woman who was absolutely no match for how willful I am. And after a few months, I went to a meeting in Chelsea, which is where I was living at the time, and I ran across a gentleman called Rich G, who's one of our members here. And he said to me, I've heard your story, and I think that I have somewhere you should be going. And I looked at him and I thought quietly, what does he know about where I should be going? I mean, who is he to be an expert? And the next day, the next week, I saw him again. And having done nothing about going to the meeting he was speaking of, I was a little embarrassed and I hid. The next week, I saw him again and I thought, this is ridiculous. I have to deal with it. And I said to him, I'd like to make a date with you so that I come and meet you at your meeting, so that at least I'll know somebody. And he named a location that I remember as being Midtown in the old days. I came and I met him here, and I actually went to the Thursday meeting where everybody gets up and says, I've been, you know, this is my sobriety date, and this is who sponsors me. And I was so dumbfounded at the fact that we were going to sit there and listen to everybody in the room say that. I didn't quite know what to make of it. But I got one good message that stayed with me that day, and that is, you're supposed to do things that you don't want to do. And I hadn't wanted to go there, and I didn't want to find a sponsor there, and I didn't want to keep going there, so I did it. So thank you, Joan Morgan, and for being my sponsor, and thank you, Peggy, for the structure and the fact of this meeting and everything it's done for me. I've been here for 18 months. It's a wonderful place to come. If you're new, please keep coming back. You'll never find a meeting where people are more responsible about giving back than you'll find at this meeting. People are wonderfully welcoming, and even people like me that like to sort of skirt around on the edge get somehow or other sucked in. Thank goodness for that, and thank you very much indeed for letting me speak tonight.
Our main speaker tonight is Rick.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rick. I'm an alcoholic. Here because I don't want to drink. If you're here and you do want to drink, that's okay. Because when I first got here, that's what I wanted to do. So my sobriety date is September 4th, 1986. And I have a sponsor, Bob D. And I sponsor guys. And my home group is the Action Group in Ocean City, Maryland. It meets Friday night and Monday night at 8 o'clock, 3rd Street and the Boardwalk. If you're ever down, come on down. And, you know, I said, you know, if you're new here, welcome. When I got here, I thought, what a revolting development this turned out to be. You know? Anyhow, I like that in front of me. But, I started drinking when I was 10, and me and my friend Chuck were out in this tent. My parents used to let us camp out, quote unquote, in the backyard, and we got some booze, and we drank it, and I thought, wow, I like this. And Chuck had some, and he didn't like it so much. He didn't feel well. And I couldn't wait to do it again, and that was, you know, I don't know. I probably had more my last month out there than he has had his whole life. So that's the difference between an alcoholic and non-alcoholic. It did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Didn't do anything for him except make him feel bad. Now, I know a lot of heavy drinkers who are not alcoholics, you know, but it doesn't do for them what it does for me. They just drink the drink. You know, when they have to go home because they have to work tomorrow, they go home. You know. I don't do that. You know, I remember in high school, I went to any lengths to drink. Because alcohol did for me what it, you know, I couldn't do for myself. In our book here, it says men and women drink mainly for the effect produced by alcohol. And the effect was it made me feel better. Made everything okay. You know? And, you know, the thing about this disease is that how can the thing that makes me feel better hurt me? You know? I went on drinking all through school and, you know, when I got out of school, I had this job that I found out that the salesman got to drink a lot. So I knew what I wanted to be. I was going to be a salesman because they went out and took customers out. And the, you know, I drank every day. Every day. I drank myself up the ladder. I don't know if I also drank myself down the ladder too, but the reason I say that is because alcohol was a power greater than me that I could depend on to get me where I wanted to go. Now, our big book says in here, and there is a solution, that the main problem with the alcoholic lies in his mind. And that's my thinking. That's my plan, you know. And it wasn't a problem in the beginning. It actually worked for me. It was a power I depended on. I did it daily. I went to any lengths to get it. And now AA does the same thing. It's a power I depend on from the God that I found, refound, by doing these steps and coming to AA. And it does for me what I can't do for myself. That's one of the promises. But, you know, when I was going up the ladder, you know, there was no thought of alcoholism or me being an alcoholic, you know, because everything worked. Now, if you checked with my first wife, you might have gotten a different interpretation. But, you know, I was one of these guys. I'd start at noon usually every day, and, you know, I had a kind of job. I didn't have to go back to the office, so that was good. And, you know, we just had fun. And then we'd meet at 5 o'clock for the rest of the poor guys that had to work. And then we'd go for a few hours bar hopping, and then we'd disperse on our own and got in all kinds of trouble on our own. But I did it on a daily basis. And I considered it part of my job. You know, I considered it part of my job. I remember, you know, I had a wife and a couple kids, and when I got married and I took those wedding vows, I meant them. Anybody do that? Or the next morning, you know, when you come in and you're getting the evil eye, and we make the promise, you know, I'm going to come home tonight, and I meant it. I really meant it. But I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't know what this book says in the doctor's opinion. I didn't know that I depended on that drinking more than I thought, you know. In the doctor's opinion, it says a couple of things. It says alcoholics have an obsession of the mind. If you don't believe that, find one of us with a resentment and see if you can get him to talk about something else. Okay? So, and that's one of the problems. And I was obsessing because this always, you know, I'm still getting the wow factor out of drinking. I obsessed about that. You know, that was cool. I just couldn't wait to do it, and I had fun with it, and I had a lot of fun with it. I traveled all over the country doing it. And the other thing it says, in a doctor's opinion, besides, we drink for the effect, we have an obsession of the mind, and when I drink, the phenomenon of craving kicks in. Now, what is that? You know? And for me, what that is that when I put alcohol in my body, you know, I want another one. If this feels good, another one's going to feel better. And I go right past that point of, you know, probably ought to stop without even batting an eye because I'm still thinking about feeling better, even if I have to lie to myself. And remember, the problem lies in my mind, and I lie to myself. I still lie to myself today, almost 24 years sober. You know, and I believed a lie. If you don't think we believed a lie, get a sponsee. Listen to them. And they really believe what they're telling you. Okay? And this is proven over and over and over to me. I've sponsored probably several hundred guys since I got here. And, you know, watch that perception change by doing these steps, the spiritual awakening that we get as a result of these steps. You know, in AA, we have two kinds of awakenings. We have the spiritual awakening, which is our new perception of things, having done the steps, and usually have a God in our lives by this time, some sort of higher power. And the result of the spiritual awakening is we get some hope, right? We feel good, you know? A little bit of the wow. And then there's the other kind of awakening we get here. It's called the rude awakening. I've got a lot of practice with the rude awakening, too. Now, the rude awakening is where we don't do the steps. We don't have a higher power that we're dependent on. We don't call sponsors or share with other people. We just use my plan. And then we keep getting these rude awakenings, you know. You would think, you know, after doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, that I would try something different. Well, in my mind, I do. I just sort of plan it a little different, but I'm still going to do it my way. Right to the point that I worked my way up the ladder. I started, when I got to the top, you know, I was invincible in my mind. Now, the president of the company would not agree with that. If I hadn't had so much business in this one particular printing company I was at, I would have been fired. And I used to do a lot of stupid things at the end of my drinking. I had one time I was here in New York, and I had called my wife, and I promised her. I hadn't seen the outside of the doghouse in a while. I lived in McLean, Virginia, at an apartment up here on Madison Avenue. And I called her up about 5 o'clock, and I had already had a few drinks. And I said, I want to come home. I'll get the 7 o'clock shuttle and have dinner, and I want to save this marriage. And I meant it. You know how we mean it? I meant it. And then my magic magnifying alcoholic mind kicked right into action and lied to me and says, you got time for another one. I already paid the bar check now. So, quick, have a couple more. And then I figured, well, it's time to get in the car. And I'm going out to the car, and a pretty blonde was coming down the street, and my mind started lying to me again. And I wound up in Maui, Hawaii with her that night. Now, I meant it when I said it. But here's the problem with the alcoholism. I got a mind that I believe. Instantly, my mind said, well, I'm not going to get anything if I go home. She's pissed off at me. So why bother? Now, how would I know this unless I tried it? But see, I'm lying. I'm coming up with these lies, and I'm believing them. In this book, it says a lot of places, real or fancied. A couple times it says fancied or real for a little variety. It also has it in a 12 and 12. Because if I think it comes out of my head, it's got to be gospel truth. And I believe it. So I believed that, why waste my time going home? And off I went. Now, that didn't go over real well when I got home. But that's the kind of things I did. And then the guilt and remorse, you know, I'm sure some of you had guilt and remorse. You know, how do you get rid of that stuff? That's like 24/7 going on. You got to drink. You got to take something. You got to do something to shut those voices up. So it just became a never-ending cycle. Never-ending cycle. And I had to, you know, my brilliant mind told me to quit this job, you know, that I was doing so well at it. And now that was not one of my brighter ideas. I wish I had a sponsor. I could have run that one by. And that was the beginning of my downturn. And I went down real fast. I drank for 28 years. And I quit that job in 82. And I got sober in 86. And during that downturn, I did stupid things like one time I had a job. And you know how we tend to lie? I had convinced this president of the company that, you know, I had ordered a new car, and it's going to take 6 weeks to get the new car. And I needed a company car to drive to make sales calls. And I hadn't made a sales call in a couple years. I just go to the bar. So he said, well, you know, you can drive. I got a new Lincoln Town Car that you can drive till your car comes in and make your sales calls. And it was in the company's name. He said, I'll use my personal car. I said, okay. And like a week later, 3 o'clock in the morning in front of a strip joint in D.C., I sold the company car for $500. Cash. Now, it seemed like a good idea at the time, you know. I believed myself. Now, that was probably another one. If I had a sponsor, he probably wouldn't say, I don't think that's a good idea, Rick. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff I did, you know. And finally, when I got here, you know, I had a restraining order on me from my wife had left me. She said, you're crazy. you know, I'm out of here. And it was a little more explicit than that, but... So anyhow, I thought, well, this is good news, you know, and now I can do whatever I want. And the thing was that, you know, I kept going down. The only time I could see my kids or talk to them was on their birthday. And my son's 10th birthday was September 4th, 1986. It's my sobriety date. And on the way to, they had fired me from the last, I went through a series of jobs. I lasted probably a couple months, and then 7 weeks and 6 weeks. This one lasted about 2 weeks. And he fired me, and actually it was more than that, not much. Fired me and told me he's going to press charges for embezzlement or get me help. What was my choice to be? Now, a normal person would not do what I did. I'm thinking, I wonder how much time I'm going to have to do for embezzlement. That's not right thinking. I agree what it says in here, the problem's in our mind. Maybe you don't have that problem, but I do, and the guys I sponsor, they come up with some even dumber stuff than that. And so if you want a good laugh, get a sponsee, you know? And you see yourself in the mirror believing these lies with they look you right in the eye and they lie because they believe it because that's what I did. Now, what that got me was homeless. It got me, you know, broke. That car that I supposedly ordered was repossessed. I mean, I didn't order any car because by then I didn't have any credit. And I went from this big sales executive to homeless, no fixed address, lost everything. You know, my kids hated me. And, you know, I'm thinking, I wonder how much time I'll have to do for this when somebody's offering to help me. I didn't know that the owner of this company was in AA. That was a gift from God. I didn't see it as a gift from God. I told you, what a revolt and development this turned out to be. And I said, if I go to this rehab, can I have my job back? And he said, no. And, you know, so I wind up in this rehab in Fairfax Hospital in Fairfax, Virginia. And this one guy would bring meetings in a couple times a week. His name was Bob. And he one night he spoke, speaker's meeting. And he told my story in a different industry. Same deal, lost everything. I had warrants. I had people after me, I hadn't filed taxes, you know, and he had a new Cadillac. And I thought, wow, wonder what he did. You know, lost everything. Now, I wasn't really that interested in getting sober. I just wanted to come back to where I was. And he said to me, he said, are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober? And I said, like what? And he said, I want you to go back to your room and get down on your knees and say any prayers you can think and write a gratitude list. And I looked at him like, what? And I started to walk away, and he yelled at me, then you're going to die, Rick. And he did this in front of all these people, you know, after the meeting. And I know God touched my shoulder and turned me around. I know it. And I turned to him. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, start paying attention and listening. Quit thinking about yourself. Go to back and do it. And I went. I said, okay. And I went back, and I got on my knees, and I had my legal pad, and I wrote gratitude list on the top. And my roommate in the motorcycle gang was on the other bed playing with himself. And I'm on my knees, you know, and I'm praying. And I'm looking over at him, you know, and, oh, no, and I just yelled out, God help me, as loud as I could. I mean, I screamed it. I screamed it. And all of a sudden, a feeling came over me that I knew it was going to be okay. Because I meant it. I really meant it this time. And there was a little spiritual awakening there. First of many. And it came to me that I had something to be grateful for, And it was, maybe there was hope. And that's what I wrote down. It's the only thing I could think of. You know, I had explained to him about my trouble. No, I don't know where I'm going from here. I didn't have a dollar to my name. You know, owed everybody money, on and on. You know how we're good at victims? Anybody good victim in here? Usually when we get here, we're pretty good victims. You can carry that on for years if you don't do the steps. The problem is, with being a victim, you got to stick with it. You know, my problem was not me or alcohol or alcoholism, it was you. Them, you know. And so I told him the next night, I said, I had a good night's sleep last night, and I thought of something. He said, well, put good night's sleep on the list. Now, the problem, that was okay, but then I got a, when I finally got a job, I was staying on some guy's couch who was in the rehab with me. When I finally got a job, they moved me, it was a printing company out of D.C. that moved me up to sell in New York. And so I moved to Hoboken. I went from homeless to Hoboken, and I'm sure there's somebody here, but I did not consider that a step up at the time. That was in 86. It wasn't as nice as it is now, but, you know, so I'm still being the victim, you know. And I wound up in his home group. I used to come to meetings here in Midtown, downstairs, when they had them here. You mentioned. And I wound up in his home group, and they had this guy met me at the door. So I was ready to drink about 6 months sober, and I called intergroup, and I found out they had this meeting in Hoboken, and I went over, and I was sponsoring myself too now. Here's a good idea for you if you want to keep the victim stuff going. And the problem with that, and here's what how my sponsor described that. He says, you were trying to fix what's wrong with you with what's wrong with you. You're thinking. And my life got worse. But this guy, Tony, says, I'm Tony. Welcome to the Path to Serenity. That was the name of the group. He says, we all go out after the meeting for pizza. And I thought, I'd scan the room, and there were some pretty girls. And I said, well, I'm going for pizza. He said, but we have a business meeting after the meeting. And he said, so they had the business meeting and they were looking for a coffee maker. So Tony says, I nominate Rick. And everybody says, second. I didn't want to be the coffee maker. You know, I wasn't even sure why I was there. But it, you know what, thank God for that, because what happened about 6 months later or so, I was ready to drink. I had an experience with this relationship that I had going in my head that she would let me drive her home after the meeting, and I, you know, I'm naming kids, you know. And then one day, you know, she told me, I reminded her of her father, and I knew her father was a salesman, and I thought, this is good. And then she says, I hate my father. I said, oh, no. And so I was really upset, and I did her inventory for her in writing. I wrote it down, and I slid it under the door. And then at that meeting, it was a 12 and 12 step meeting, and somebody said, if you don't have a sponsor, pray for one. And God will ask God to put him in your life, and you'll know it when you see him. And I had been doing that, okay? And the night I was going to go get drunk after this, you know, AA doesn't work. I can't even get a decent date, you know, and I'm about to lose my job, and I feel like hell, and, you know, I was victim galore, and about to lose my apartment, and I'm thinking AA doesn't work, but I'm going to go to the meeting, make the coffee, and at least they can't say I didn't make the coffee, and then I'm going to go to New York and get drunk. And that was the night I met my sponsor. And I knew it. He said, I haven't had trouble sleeping in about 11 years. And I went up when he was talking. He was doing a four-step. And by the way, they had a person at the meeting had to read the four-step from the 12 and 12. You know how long that takes? And they picked her to read it. So I had to listen to her read the step. So that just sort of fueled this resentment going. And then he said, I haven't had trouble sleeping in almost 11 years. And I thought, whoa. I went up to him afterwards, and I said, I knew there had to be some kind of AA-approved pill, you know, so you can sleep. And I said, what do you take to sleep? And he smiled at a big, nice, big Irish guy. He says, I took the 12 steps the Big Book way, and I just wanted to punch him, you know? And the thing was, but he had these pretty girls with him. They brought over from New York here somewhere. And I said, well, this home group sucks anyhow. I'm going to go to his home group because he doesn't need all them. See, I still thought I knew what I needed to be fixed. You know, I thought, and that's why I got in all this trouble, because I knew what I needed to be fixed. I needed another sale. I needed a girl. I need whatever it was I dreamt up that day. I need my wife to forgive me. Whatever, I'll be okay if. And the doctor's opinion says, don't put any conditions on your sobriety. Tell your new man. Job or job, wife or no wife. Whatever, money or no money, don't put conditions on. Tell him out front. And this, he was one of those guys. And it turned out to be a men's no sympathy meeting where they would cut you off in the middle of the meeting if you weren't talking about the solution in a minute. Everybody had to share. I was explaining to him my tale of woe, you know, and this guy George cuts me off. He says, "What step is that you're working on, Rick? What page is that on?" And so it helped get a resentment list going. And Bobby became my sponsor, and he got me into the steps right away. And one night after the meeting, it was a Thursday night meeting, and he had me he said, "We're going to do the fifth step on Saturday night. And that means you got to get that fourth step done." And he said it after the meeting in front of the guys, and I didn't want to look embarrassed like I didn't know how to do it. Of course, I hadn't looked in here. But so I said, okay, and I called him later, and he walked me through it on the phone. About a half hour, we read the chapter, and took about 3 hours, including that. That's all it took. So if you're afraid of doing a four-step, you can get it done faster than you can get a good drunk on, you know? Do it. Because the result was great. I did the fifth step, and he prayed, and he says, "God, ourselves, and another human being." He said, "Lord, let us learn from this what you want us to learn from this." And what I found out, I was selfish and self-centered in the extreme. He also had me going over to this meeting, Serenity East, back then. They had a third and 11th step meeting, and he told me to volunteer to read the third and 11th step before the leader would speak. And I said to him, "You think I'm selfish and self-centered?" And he just laughed. Because I didn't get it until I read that. And I really didn't get it until I did the fifth step, when I saw what my part in this big mess was. And as he explained to me, "You know, the one common denominator here, Rick, in all this mess?" I said, "What's that?" He said, "You. You're involved in every one of these screwed up deals." And my life was based on being on you people doing what I thought you should do. And I'm almost 24 years sober, and I sponsor a lot of guys, and they sponsor a lot of guys, and none of us have found anybody that's getting their way, that people are doing what they think they ought to be doing. So that's a bad plan for happiness. So I had to learn about acceptance. I did my eighth step list and went down and went over the things on it, and I started doing the ninth steps. He told me, write them all down and skip a couple lines. And he said, some of them you'll be right, some of them you'll be wrong. And I had to write down what the right amend was going to be in case I saw him. And then he got right on me. And I was, who'd you see this weekend? Or, you know? And you know what? I got to the IRS. It was this time of year. And he said, "Well, what about the IRS? I said, "Well, I'm afraid." He says, "Well..." He says, "The IRS bigger than your God?" I said, "Yeah, I think so." And I was serious. I was real serious. I thought I was going to jail. I hadn't filed in a long time. And he said, "Well, then you need a bigger God, Rick." No truer words were ever said. And that can probably apply to any time I get full of myself, full of fear. It means I'm putting all my hope in me, instead of God, that I found from doing these steps. that gave me that first good night's sleep, you know. So that's how I got through. I went down there the next day, and I worked a deal. It took me 12 years to pay him off. But, man, that was so cool. Wasn't cool that day. But it, when you write that last check, man, there's no better feeling. And I'm current today. Filed. You know? And that, what a good feeling. You know, I need somebody else to run my life. You know, we get the promises here. If you don't think you had a power greater than yourself when you were drinking, I'm just going to read a couple of these promises. Except I'm going to preface them with, after a few drinks, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness after a few drinks. After a few drinks, we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. After a few drinks, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. You know, I had a few drinks. That was my power greater than me. When you come in here, you have no power. I was stark, raving, sober, crazy. And, you know, thank God for the sponsor and AA and you people to just set me straight. You know, thank God for that. I know today there's a lot of little one-liners I'm going to end up with. One of them is when I was going through my fourth step and fifth step with my sponsor, I would explain to him what this person did to me, you know. And even now, I'll call him up and I'll say, she did this, and I said this, and I said, you know, we set it up when we call our sponsor to make sure we look right, you know. So he can't say, no, you're wrong, Rick. So I set it up, and I tell him, you know, she did this, and I said this, and, you know. And then he's going along, And he says, that it? I said, yeah. He says, is she one of those humans? I said, yeah. He said, that's what they do. And that's how I learned to let, you know, forgiveness. That's what they do. Let them be human. When I was full of myself, you know, full of the bondage of self, and you all weren't doing what I thought you ought to be doing, that's what happened. I was never satisfied. When I worked this program, due to steps, let you be human, I'm okay. All those kids that hated me when I got sober, I'm so close with now. My ex-wife came up to me at my son's, I cried this, my son's wedding a few years ago and gave me a hug and said, I'm proud of you. That's not what you used to say to me, especially when that time I came home from Hawaii, you know. But, you know, that, what a great feeling. She said, because we took our, I got married to Sarah here. I met her in New York. And we took my two kids at 5 years sober, and they lived with us. So, you know, miracles happen. All the great stuff that's happened, I couldn't have imagined. But, you know, if you keep coming and do what you're supposed to do, you'll be okay. It says, the purpose of the book is to find a power that will solve your problem. My problem was me and my plan. My old solution didn't work anymore. This one does. Thank you, everybody.